The Commentary Track, conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello, welcome back to the Commentary Track. I am your genial host, Frank Thompson, who believes, as I always have, for the woman the kiss, for the man the sword. We have a really great show tonight. David Keene. David is the historian at the Niles S&A Silent Film Museum in Fremont, or as we call it, Niles. He wrote a wonderful book called Bronco Billy and the S&A Film Company, which I think I bought the very second it was in print. I ran and jumped on the conveyor belt as they were coming out of the printer, and I pounced on it and ran out the door laughing maniacally. It is a great book. I have a special love for the Nickelodeon era in film, and so going to Niles is always such a treat for me. The theater there is a real silent film theater and looks like one, and it really replicates the experience of what it would have been like in the teens and 20s in a small town movie theater, always with live piano accompaniment and just terrific movies. It's a great place to go. And David is a great person to talk to. He is a bit soft-spoken, and I always felt like I'm yelling around him, but I think I feel like that about most people, and most people tell me, stop yelling. But David really has a lot to say, talks in fascinating detail about the history of the S&A Film Company, first in Chicago and then in Niles and Bronco Billy and Charlie Chaplin and all the many people who made movies there, and talks about how he got his book together. And as you'll hear me, I'm green with jealousy for the great treasure troves he found in, as he was doing his search. Really wonderful stuff. And he also, a couple of years ago, discovered something really wonderful. There's a film called A Trip Down Market Street that was always dated to 1905, shot in San Francisco, that just goes from one end of Market Street to the other. And it was one of those films, very typical of its time, that just showed a location. And it's one of those things that's such a valuable window into history. But even more so when David started doing really great detective work and discovered something remarkable about that film, which we'll talk about later on in this interview. So you'll hear it. Just be patient. So here's my talk with the great David Keene, and we'll see you on the other side. Were you always interested in film? Did you intend to be a filmmaker?
Movies always interested me since childhood. I was about maybe 12 years old when I got a hold of my father's 8mm camera, and my younger brother and I would make short films, and filmmaking seemed to be the most interesting thing to me when I was growing up, and I couldn't really imagine doing anything else.
Now, where were you?
I grew up in Yuba City, born in Woodland, California, and we moved to Yuba City when I was 9, and my brother and I always did a lot of things together. There was, you know, in those days in the late 50s and early 60s growing up, it seemed like children were much more on their own. And we did all kinds of things together, and my parents didn't seem to really care about what, you know, things we got into, digging forts and sure, empty lots and riding our bicycles around town. And
you and I had the same childhood.
One of those things was making comic books, flip books, and movies, and there was, in those days, you could go into a drugstore and buy silent films off a rack. And we did some of that and showed silent films for neighborhood kids with my father's 8mm projector. And I didn't even know it then, but I bought one of Buster Keaton's films, Balloonatic, and you know, Chaplin and Laurel and Hardy. In those days, you could look at movies on TV from the 30s and 40s. They were, you know, all kinds of rare things that you just don't often see anymore, except on TCM, I guess. But in those days, you know, I loved the Marx Brothers and W.C. Fields and Joey Brown and Abbott and Costello and, you know, lots of other movies, too, that you just... One day I turned on the TV set and there was the Jazz Singer.
Wow.
In the daytime, you know. So it was a great time to be watching movies and discovering them. And that interested me more than anything else.
Yeah, it really was a time that I don't think we've valued until fairly recently, thinking back on it, because... In early TV, well, it wasn't that early, but in my case, in the early 60s, local TV channels just needed filler, and so they would just show old movies.
Mm-hmm.
So we were always seeing stuff from the early 30s and early sound films.
Yeah.
Then all the kids shows would show Betty Boop and early Popeye and all that stuff. So we were seeing great stuff.
Yeah, all the Laurel and Hardy talkies saw on TV and Three Stooges. And, I spent my childhood in front of the TV when I wasn't, out and about doing things between those two things. You know, I really wasn't much interested in kids in school or even reading. I just like to watch movies.
Yeah. Now, everybody watched those movies when we were kids, but only a few of us kept watching those movies. So what do you think made you maintain your interest in them?
I've just been, I think, visually oriented and... I really liked the story aspect of films. Narrative stories always interested me. And it just was, I guess, a means to go into another world for me and lose myself and, you know, endlessly entertaining.
Were you interested in the past in general? I mean, in history, or because that was part of the appeal for me was, you know, you turn on this movie from 1929, and suddenly there are the cars that they drove and the way their houses looked, and all that stuff was really interesting to me.
I think to a certain extent, but I didn't really focus on that until a little later. Because we would often, as a family, come to San Francisco, there was that aspect of the history of San Francisco, and but there wasn't so much of that where I was growing up. People really didn't. In the 50s and 60s, it was a pretty sad time for most history, it seems to me. Things were getting torn down, and... and I don't think the history was as valued as a little later or just by certain people. But, you know, again, with TV, for instance, I saw Silence Please, and that's the first time I think I was really connected to silent films as something in the past and... something that seemed interesting, too. Lon Chaney was real interest to me. And, you know, I looked at the famous Monsters of Filmland magazine all the time. And there was an encyclopedia that my parents had got for my older brother in the 40s. And it had a whole huge section on motion pictures and a whole page on just Lon Chaney's makeups for many different films. And I used to look at that read through those entries. But the different character makeups really fascinated me, too. And even when Fractured Flickers came on, I was enjoyed that a lot. And it wasn't because I thought that they made fun of silent films. Again, it was the way they told the stories mm-hmm. and just used those images to put it all together.
Plus, it was funny.
I was really... I really enjoyed comedies more than the dramas at that age. And I remember watching TV with the Marx Brothers film and just falling off the chair laughing.
Yeah, I think, certainly in terms of old films, Laurel and Hardy and Our Gang were the mainstays of my childhood mm-hmm. that I didn't quite realize were made, you know, 30 years before I was born. But mm-hmm. it didn't matter. I mean, it never occurred to me, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when Alfalfa Switzer was killed, I was in the first grade. And on the playground, we talked about it. And we all assumed that Butch had done it. Who else would have been mean enough to do this?
So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, all that stuff, I mean, because of Castle Films and what was on television, it was not unusual to see Laurel and Hardy or even Chaplin or Keaton.
Mm-hmm.
But it was unusual to see Bronco Billy, yeah. Billy Anderson. So how did that interest come about?
I really didn't see any of his stuff until I started doing research. I'd gone into college not knowing where I would end up, what I wanted to do. I just knew that I enjoyed movies and wanted to be part of that somehow. And it took me a long time to get into the history part. I wanted to make films. And made my first 16-millimeter film when I was at Yuba Junior College in Marysville. We actually, somehow, my brother and our friends got a special credit class together from a theater teacher who we decided to... He put on a play, from a one-act play of one of his things, and my brother and some of his friends in the theater class had been part of the crew, and so we decided to make this film of his one-act play. And we bought a camera, 16-millimeter camera, Kodak Cine Special, and about 3,000 feet of black and white reversal film, and a developing kit, and went to the river bottoms in Yuba River, and shot over a couple weekends making this film. It ended up being 45 minutes long. Mm. And so it was quite a production. And I realized from that process really interested me. I was one of the cameramen on the shoot. And
you didn't use sound, did you? Yeah.
We recorded with a two-track reel-to-reel recorder, thinking we were going to redub the whole thing and not knowing enough to realize how difficult that would be, actually buying the film with a magnetic soundtrack on it and thinking that we would be able to do it that way. None of us having any experience in making a film before, of course. I had done still photography stuff before, had my own dark room, and so I knew how to develop still film, but I'd never done movie film before. And at the college, they had this 200-foot Steinman reel that I took into my dark room and developed it, all the film footage there. And it took about 5 rolls of film to figure out how to do it right. So we messed up some of the footage, of course. And I ended up building an optical printer to try and copy some of the footage that had been blotched up and otherwise messed up. When we finally figured out how to develop it, the footage looked really great. In fact, I still got the footage. And I still got the camera, too, that we used. It's a great camera. It's the kind of camera that the Disney wildlife photographers would use to shoot their movies. Wonderful camera.
Now, did you finish the film?
We never really finished it. I was editing it while I was still at San Francisco State a little later. Because of the technical problems, simply couldn't overcome those. And I did a few little things over the next couple of years to try and do something with that, but it was never really done. And I actually ended up doing a one-reel silent version with title cards in it.
So you did finish it in a way.
Yeah, I did. Only about a 15-minute version. All of it copied on my optical printer.
So otherwise, it's like Orson Welles' Other Side of the Wind. We're waiting
for the
complete restoration.
That's right. And maybe it'll happen someday. But that's been 40 years since we started that. So it's a long time in coming.
It's never too late.
No.
Never too late.
But that really sparked my interest in doing films in a professional capacity. And as a result of that, I ended up going to San Francisco State, making films there. I couldn't get into the film department, so I went to the art department and made films there. It was pretty loose organization, and so they pretty much allowed you to do whatever you wanted. I did a couple of documentary-type things there. And after I graduated, I didn't know how I could possibly get into the film business. So I worked for my father. He was an electrical contractor back in Yuba City for 6 years and was totally miserable. During that time, I got married, and we had 2 kids, and I felt trapped in this job and didn't really want to continue in my father's business. And eventually had a divorce, but my wife was really concerned and accommodating about what I wanted to do for my future, because she knew that I still had this interest in film, but didn't know if it was something that I could make happen. And so we investigated the possibility of going to AFI. They were having their, you know, one-year filmmaking course at that time. I think you could go for a second year if you were interested. I couldn't really afford that, but an alternative was Berkeley Film Institute, which had a six-week summer course, intensive course of filmmaking. You ended up making three films in 6 weeks, I think it was. Mm. So I went there, and that's when I decided maybe I could make something of this. And didn't have a particular interest in going to Los Angeles, but there was things going on in the Bay Area. And I ended up getting a job at Adolph Gasser's camera store that had sales and rentals of motion picture equipment. And I ended up staying there for 12 years as a camera technician eventually in the rental department, became the head of the camera department.
Were you still making films all that time?
Yeah. The great thing about working at Gasser's was that if the equipment wasn't being used, the employees could borrow it for free.
Oh, great.
And so I would, some of my former classmates at Berkeley Film Institute, we would get together and make things that, you know, some of them had various projects they were working on, and I would contribute in some way, either as a sound recordist or a assistant cameraman or in some cases a cameraman. So I continued to do that. Eventually, there was one film that I co-produced with two other friends, and we got an AFI grant of $20,000 to finish it, just a two-reel short film. But it took 5 years to finish. It took 5 years to get the money, really. We'd gotten some seed money to start it, and we'd stop, and I'd edit the film, and we'd see how far we got, and then we would, if we could get some more money, then we'd shoot some later. And after three tries at the AFI grant, we finally got that. We also got a small Western States grant. I think it was about $3,000, and that kept us going until we got the AFI grant and finally finished up the film. But it was quite an ordeal to get.
What was that film about?
It was called Fragrant Night, and it was about the experiences of some teenagers over the course of an evening. One of the main teenagers loses his dog and convinces his friends to help find the dog, and they never actually get the dog. But there's, you know, the romance angle and the friends getting into trouble and doing things over the course of a night. And it turned out, I think, very well. But by the time we were finished, we were so exhausted from doing it all that we entered into a few film festivals and it didn't get anywhere, and we pretty much gave up on it. We made several prints of it, thinking that we would, you know, get them far and wide, but we never really did pursue it as aggressively as we did making the film. You know, we'd kind of worn out by that time and really didn't, after the few disappointments of the film festivals, that it didn't go anywhere. We went on to other things. But
didn't your cast grow out of their ages?
That was the other problem, yeah. We had, after the first year, I don't think we ever got any of the major players back, and we were shooting from behind, things to make it all fit together, so that it would look seamless. And You know, I think probably the two main girl and boy characters, we probably used about five different people in various scenes in the years later when they weren't available. And nobody who saw the film realized that until we told them that how much trouble we'd had with it. So it was quite a, you know, making films is the only way to learn how to make films.
Sure.
You know, you can study about it all you want, but doing it is really the greatest education to making a film.
Well, now you know what they went through when they were making, what was it, Saratoga Trunk, when Gene Harlow died?
Oh, my gosh.
Midway through, and then they had to bring somebody else and fake it out for the rest of the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's amazing now.
So you've lived it.
Yeah. Yeah. Filmmaking is nothing but lies.
Yes. Making the films and dealing with the people who make the films.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. Yeah. I'm finishing up a documentary now, and it never ceases to amaze me how long everything takes to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I meant to have this film done in July, and we are recording this on the last day of 2012, and it's still not finished. And it's like every little thing you think, okay, this little tweak needs to be made.
Mm-hmm.
And a month later, it's still being factored through the system in some way. It's just maddening.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah. After that experience with that film, I decided raising money for filmmaking was not something that I really wanted to do anymore. So I started writing scripts. And I ended up writing about 10 screenplays in maybe 8 years or so. Never sold anything, but that's really how I learned how to write. It was a great way to figure that out. Screenplays, of course, have their own formula and own way of putting words together. But I really like the way you have to be concise and kind of visualize on the paper what the script is. And for my 11th script, I thought, well, you know, there was this film company in Niles that made movies, the S&A Film Company. In the 25 years that I'd been living in the Bay Area, I'd never come to Niles. During Fragrant Night, we'd actually shot on Mission Boulevard in Fremont and drove by, and not even knowing that Niles was here. I didn't go into Niles. We drove down Mission Boulevard towards the Mission San Jose part of Fremont without knowing that I was so close to Niles. You know, this was in the 80s, and I didn't get here until 1995 when I thought, I'll go to Niles and see what's left, and maybe I can get some background feeling for what the S&A company did. And I'd heard about Bronco Billy, never seen any of his films. And, you know, I'd seen The Tramp, but I didn't really connect that up to S&A and what they were doing before. So I came to Niles in August of 1995 to do this background stuff for this screenplay. And I was so blown away by this little town and how it still looked so much like it did 100 years ago that I thought, if I can find more information somehow, I think this really deserves to be more than a screenplay. A screenplay wouldn't do it justice. It needs to be a book, if I can find enough information. And so I went through the regular resources, newspapers, and found some magazine stuff. And I noticed that they were essentially repeating the same stories over and over in these short articles that really didn't give much more information. But as I went through trade papers and local surviving newspapers, I started to get a picture of things that hadn't been recorded before. And I became obsessed by it. It was really the first professional style research I'd done. In the 70s, when I was in San Francisco, going to San Francisco State, the Buster Keaton films were revived, and Raymond Rohauer was showing the whole series of features and shorts together, and four blocks from me was the Surf Theater, where they showed that whole series, and I had gone every night to see every Buster Keaton film, fell in love with Keaton, and Arbuckle, too. I really became interested in Arbuckle, and there really hadn't been much written at that point about Arbuckle, and I started going to the San Francisco Library and looking at the trade magazines, researching Arbuckle. So that's kind of the first research that I'd done before, but this SNA stuff was like a leap years, way above what I'd done before. I'd kind of figured out the basics when I was doing the Arbuckle stuff, but with this SNA stuff, I was practically traveling somewhere just about every day. I was able to, by this point, I'd stopped working at Gasser's, and I was actually a consultant, and they had needed, the rental business was changing, but there were still three people in that department, and the turnover was tremendous. You know, in camera rental departments for motion pictures, that's kind of a starting point for people who want to be an assistant or something in the business. Mm-hmm. And so you'd get somebody in there for like 4 or 6 months, and they'd get a job from somebody who came in to get equipment, and they'd be off and, trying to make a living in, as a first assistant or a second assistant or anything. And so I was training people all the time at Gasser's as a consultant. So I pretty much was able to call my own schedule. And as a result of that, I traveled on libraries all around the Bay Area looking at microfilm, the trade magazines, Moving Picture World, New York Dramatic Mirror, photography, anything that was available anywhere. And I started widening my circle, going to Los Angeles. And one of the big problems was finding photographs that I could afford. There weren't any to find here in the Bay Area. I was really surprised that the Bancroft Library, such a great library, no photographs at all. Or the California Historical Society. I found one photograph at the California State Library. Mm. There were quite a few at the Margaret Harriet Library in Beverly Hills, but I couldn't afford to spend that kind of money on them. And I wanted to have a lot of photographs in this book because they took so many, and it was such a great visual reference to what they had been doing. And at these articles that you'd see that had been around before, they were using the same ones over and over, and the quality was terrible. And so I figured, I'm doing all this research, maybe I can track down families of all of these SNA people. And one of my co-producers on the Fragrant Night film, Helen Caswell, she had been a telemarketer for a while and knew how to talk to people on the phone. And I was terrified and and totally incompetent at calling somebody I didn't know and talk to them and convince them that, you know, if they – I didn't even know if these people I would need to call were the right people I was looking for, and that was even more terrifying to me. So I gave her all the information that I was gathering about these people and hopefully the, being the relatives of these SNA actors and crew people. And as a result of that, I found 50 families of SNA cast and crew people and over 1,000 photographs. Families had kept these photographs.
That's incredible.
Yeah. There were some I tracked down the granddaughter of the staff photographer. She had two photo albums of photographs that were shot here in Niles. I tracked down the son of Leo West, who was a scenic painter, and he had a stack of about 100 photographs that had just been gathering dust in his garage. He gave them all to me. Another photo album of Fred Church's, over 100 photographs starting in 1909 when they were in Colorado and going through all their trips to everywhere that Bronco Billy had been in the West. And so that's what made it possible for having 260 photographs in the book. All of these families who, in some cases, the families didn't even know that their relatives had been in the films, and they didn't have anything, of course, and they asked me for information and photographs. But there were maybe 7 or 8 families that had an amazing amount of stuff. And beyond that, I found one collection at USC that belonged to Jess Robbins, who was Anderson's cameraman during this time and later the general manager at the Niles SNA studio, and I got some copies of photographs from that that weren't anywhere else. But and Sam Gill had some photographs that were unbelievable that I can't imagine how he came across that filled in some gaps too. And there were a few other people. There was, eventually I tracked down one guy who had a pharmacy in Niles in the 70s, and he was interested in the history. And people would come into his pharmacy on Niles Boulevard, and he had photographs on the wall, and people would contribute more to his collection, so he ended up having about 150 photographs. And at first he was real wary of me looking at this stuff because he probably had problems in the past. I discovered that Niles residents, nobody would say that they had anything because so many times people in the past had borrowed things and they'd never gotten them back that nobody wanted to admit to anything. And when I actually ended up meeting this pharmacist, former pharmacist actually, who was now in real estate for a company called SNA Associates.
Wow.
His name is Harry Avila, and when I told him and showed him some of the stuff that I'd gathered, he immediately opened up everything to me and let me have full access. And actually, while I was in his office, he made this phone call to somebody who'd also been interested in SNA and discovered his SNA Associates name in the phone book. And this was Diana Sarah Carey, who'd been doing research on her father and his connection to SNA and Niles. And that's the first time that I talked to Diana on the phone from his office. he called her up and immediately got us together. So that was a great thrill. Diana became a huge supporter and read the manuscript of my book and offered a lot of suggestions and was totally supportive.
And you've shown a lot of her Baby Peggy films here, haven't you?
We have, yeah. Such a great film personality and person, too.
Well, it just sounds like you hit a treasure trove of stuff. I think the most parallel project I ever worked on was the Star Film Ranch, which was San Antonio company that was the brother of Georges Méliès, Gaston mm-hmm. Méliès, started in 1910, and they were there for a year and a half in San Antonio. And I spent 6 or 7 years on and off working on that, researching that, mm-hmm. and I never found anybody, not anybody, who had been involved or whose family had been involved. Mm-hmm. And they hired a bunch of local people when they got there to be cowboys. So there were a lot of San Antonio people involved with the Star Film Company. Mm-hmm. And I never found a single descendant ever. Mm-hmm. I got the papers to write articles about me just so it would be some sort of visibility. Mm-hmm. And then I would put my email address or sometimes even my home address. Mm-hmm. Just say, got anything? Let me know. Nothing. Ever. Nothing. Mm. So I'm totally green with envy that you
came up. Yeah, it was great. You always wish you'd done it earlier when some of the people were alive, of course. I did end up meeting one guy, True Boardman, who, as a child actor, had worked here in Niles with both of his parents who were at the company. And he was living in Pebble Beach, and he did have some stuff as well. I was able to track him down thanks to Helen and phone calls. And True Boardman was just a great guy, and he didn't remember much about what was going on because he was only about 5 or 6 years old at the time. He only had a few little flashes of memory, but another great supporter. It took me about 7 years also to write that book and Bronco Billy and the SNA Film Company. And the experience of meeting all these people and making these connections, which there's still a lot of those connections that we have here. Some of them are now members of our museum and have come more than once to come to the festivals and watched their relatives on the screen. It's really satisfying that, thinking back on that when I was wanting to make movies in my 20s and 30s, and you never know where these things are going to take you. There's no training for any of this kind of stuff that brings you in a direction that you never would have expected. Being a historian at a silent film museum, what kind of lifetime plan could that be?
Yeah, they never mentioned that at Career Day.
No. No.
Well, I love your book. I just think it's a terrific book. And one of the things I love the whole Nickelodeon era of filmmaking anyway. I'm completely fascinated by all that up to 1912 or 13, when the business started to change pretty drastically around that time. Mm-hmm. But one of the things I love about the Nickelodeon period in general, but the SNA stuff very specifically, because they were headquartered here in Niles. Mm-hmm. And so all the films are basically little documentaries about Niles, too. I mean, mm-hmm. there's all this local flavor, and it really is this lovely record of what this land was like 100 years ago.
Yeah, with these hills surrounding Niles and the Alameda Creek, there's still landmarks for those films. If you watch the films, you can see those things and know pretty much where they shot everything that was outdoors. You know, you can still figure it out. And I wish at some point we could do a location plaques or something like that, like they do at Lone Pine, so that you can see all the different locations. And, you know, you can still figure out exactly where The Tramp was made with Charlie Chaplin on Niles Canyon Road because of the hills. It picks it out exactly. And there's, you know, that's not the only location as well.
And even though the road's paved, it's still basically, I mean, it's still that road.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, it sure is.
That stuff is fascinating to me.
Yeah.
Probably there are people listening who don't know that much about SNA, so it might be worth just giving a little bit of a background. I remember when I lived in Chicago for 5 years or so in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one day just I was driving somewhere else and suddenly I saw this building with this said SNA Studios on it. And mm-hmm. It was the logo and everything, this beautiful building. And I immediately went up and knocked on the door and there was nobody there.
Oh,
and I kept going there for weeks after that and never found anybody there at all. I had no idea what was being done with it. And today, I'm sure the building is still there.
Yeah, and but, the building's now St. Augustine College, and they are actually wanting to do some renovation work on it to put the historical aspects back into place. Over the years, it's gone through many different phases and owners doing things with it. A number of the windows have been blocked off with bricks, and of course the interiors have changed, and all kinds of other things have been going on. And St. Augustine is in the process of raising money to fix it up to look quite a bit like it did back then. In many respects, I was there just last October for a fundraising dinner. I was a keynote speaker for telling about the history of the studio. SNA was formed in 1907 by George Spohr and Gilbert Anderson, S and A of SNA. They ended up spelling it phonetically. It's not the only company that did that. No. Calum did it too, and others as well. And as you can imagine, the Chicago winters make it a little difficult sometimes to shoot films outdoors, especially in those days when you needed a lot of light or money to buy lighting fixtures. So Anderson actually came west looking for locations and bright sunny weather to film. He didn't actually start doing his westerns right off. They were known as the House of Comedy Hits, and their first actor was Ben Turpin, who came with Anderson west with Jess Robbins, Anderson's cameraman. Came to San Francisco in December of 1908 to make films, and were rained out. It's the first time that any of them, I guess, had been to California, and they'd heard about sunny California, but didn't realize that until they got here that maybe Southern California was the place to go. So they actually went there in December of 1908, and got arrested in Los Angeles when Ben Turpin went into a lake to catch a duck for this film that they were making. And an officer saw them and didn't like what they were doing. So when they went to the police station, the guy in charge said, "Don't ever film in Los Angeles again." And it could be that Anderson took that to heart, because he came back coming back to San Francisco, looking for locations there in later years. From 1909 to 1912, they were traveling all over the place looking for the perfect conditions. By 1909, he started making his S&A Westerns, and he was in Morrison and Golden, Colorado. He was in El Paso, Texas. They actually went down to Mexico City briefly, and Anderson didn't like that immediately. They went to Santa Barbara for 3 months in 1910. They went back to Colorado, back to Chicago for a little while, off to Los Gatos in the San Francisco Bay Area. They went to Redlands. They went to San Rafael. They went to Lakeside near San Diego. And then they finally found Niles in April of 1912. And within a week, Anderson was buying property in Niles to settle down. He knew that quickly that Niles was the place because of the canyon, the town so close by. You know, within minutes you could be into the canyon from downtown Niles. And also it was a rail hub that in those days the San Francisco Chronicle advertised the train from San Francisco to Chicago in 62 hours. Mm. And of course, San Francisco was of interest to Anderson. He actually ended up having a suite at the St. Francis Hotel where he could spend his time when he wasn't in Niles, which apparently was quite a bit of time. Anderson really cranked out his one-reel films very quickly. He was kind of proud of the speed that he could finish a film. Sometimes he would do three or four films in a week and spend the rest of the month in San Francisco. At that time, they were also producing this series called the Snakeville Comedies. Mm-hmm. So they were doing a Bronco Billy and a Snakeville Comedy every week for release. Anderson could get ahead of himself, but the rest of the company would be working on these Snakeville Comedies and maybe taking a little more time. The ones that I've seen of the Snakevilles are actually pretty entertaining. There aren't, unfortunately, very many of them surviving of the 100 or so they made. But
yes, Sam Gill and I did a program at UCLA one time, and I showed Star Films, and he showed Snakevilles. And those are the only ones I'd ever seen at that point. But they are funny. And were they in Niles, or were they somewhere else?
They started out in Santa Monica in 1911, but the majority of them were made in Niles. They made a few in San Rafael, and Bronco Billy was developing his Bronco Billy character pretty much in San Rafael at the same time. So some of the Bronco Billies were kind of combination Snakeville Bronco Billy films.
Yeah, I just saw a Bronco Billy that was set in Snakeville.
Mm-hmm.
And I got the idea that it was San Rafael.
Yeah.
Where they shot it.
Bronco Billy and the Schoolmistress?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
And, it was part of Randy Haberkamp's Century Ago program.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite annual event.
Yes.
let's talk about Anderson a little bit, because as Bronco Billy, he was really the first cowboy star.
Mm-hmm.
And I always feel sheepish about saying the first anything, but you can pretty much back that up, that he was the first cowboy star.
Yeah.
And not tailor-made to be a cowboy star by any means. I mean, he doesn't really look like what we think of as the cowboy hero.
No.
The body doesn't quite jibe with what we think of as a cowboy hero. And yet... Yeah.
Not real slick in the saddle.
No, not a good rider.
But he's got personality.
Yeah.
And that's what... That and the combination of these little moral stories that he had in 15 minutes. I think that combination was perfect for the time. And, you know, that's why he was seen around the world. There was a... He was everywhere, you yeah. know. He just... and that's... And, you know, that was the great thing about him, but also the problem as well, because his Broncobilly shorts were so popular that George Spohr wouldn't really let him get into anything else, longer films. And, you know, when short films were pretty much supplanted by features, that was the beginning of the end for Anderson. He was a smart guy, really knew what he was doing, what he wanted to do, but he was kind of trapped as the junior partner in S&A with Spohr holding the purse strings. And, you know, it worked for a while with Anderson being out west and doing essentially what he wanted to do, and Spohr being over in Chicago with his hands full with the company there, Francis X. Bushman and Edward Arnold and all the other people. The Chicago studio did a really amazing job of turning out films at a really rapid rate as well. And a lot of personnel, especially cameramen, got their start there. Really, an impressive array of people. Anderson needed somebody else. He couldn't do it on his own. And that was pretty obvious later on when he tried to make his comeback. There's some letters that came from Anderson Well that are in Jess Robbins' collection there that shows pretty much, you know, what he wanted to do, but he wasn't the organizational guy that he was hoping Jess Robbins could be. They obviously got along very well. They worked together on and off for quite a long time. But you can see in the letters, Anderson queries to Robbins, do you know where the cameras are, you know, that we're going to use to shoot this stuff? And I want to do some snake fills along with these Broncobilly features. And can you write up something for those short films? You know, so, you know, he had ideas of what he wanted to do. He just wasn't the organizational guy that could be a complete package to make it all happen. No. He was also a great promoter. The great thing about my research for S&A when they were on the road was that Anderson would immediately go to the newspaper office whenever he came into a new town and announce that he was there and they were going to make movies. And the newspaper would send out a reporter and tell how they were going about making these newfangled films that nobody had ever seen being made in these little towns. And so you have these great first-person articles about how Anderson went about making all of these short films from one location to another. And you can see how he kind of was evolving his working methods and also just the general procedure of how they went about making films. And at first, Anderson would hand out, you know, short little scripts to his players so that they could see what was going on. But by the time he really knew what he wanted to do and how quickly he wanted to do it, he would simply be telling everybody what they were going to do in each shot, and nobody knew how the film was going to begin or end or anything. He was the only one who knew that how it was going to go together. It was a great process that I think he went through. And, you know, after being involved with 500 films, it's not surprising that, you know, some people as an outsider would think how, in a way, how slapdash and unpremeditated he was doing things. But, you know, he knew how to put them together. One of the things I was worried about when I was writing the book, the films that were available on film or video that were readily accessible were not very good. There was only a handful of them. When I started going to the archives, I went to the British Film Institute and saw everything they had, and George Eastman House and Library of Congress and UCLA. I discovered that the best stuff was in the archives that nobody had seen, and some really, really good stuff that didn't need any excuses. They were really well put together. And then I could understand why he was so popular. But the regular stuff that had been available before, just, you know, the quality was bad to begin with. There were jump cuts all over everything. And most of the films, you know, simply weren't very good anyway. That was really satisfying to see that he'd actually made some good films.
Are more of those generally available now?
No, they aren't, unfortunately. And that's one of the things that we want to do here, is somehow start off with putting together a Made in Niles DVD so that people can see some of that stuff that hasn't been readily available before. Because it, you know, I think it would, that's what we've done with our festivals. We've, you know, brought things from the archives that people haven't been able to see, and it has opened some eyes to the quality of the film product that they were putting out. So it'd be nice to get a wider audience for that because it's so good.
Can you show 35 and 16 here at the theater?
Yes, we can. Yeah. Right. Yeah. We've even modified our projectors so they can do continuously variable speed with three-bladed shutters. So right. It's, you know.
Do you also show digital copies of things?
When we do our tour groups and school tours, then we show DVDs because it's got a music track on it, and that makes it convenient. But for our regular Saturday shows with live piano music that we've done in January, it'll be 8 years that we've been doing it every Saturday night, we make a point of showing film.
Yeah, we've been here for those. They're always great fun. How are the kids when the school groups come? How do the kids react to this stuff?
They're great. Well, we've learned over the years that the film that we show the kids is The Champion with Charlie Chaplin that has the boxing fight and the dog in it and all that fun stuff that children enjoy. And then for the senior group tours, we show The Tramp, because it's got a little sadness as well as the comedy, and the adults seem to enjoy that more than the kids.
That's actually, when I was a kid and realized that my local library had 8mm films that I could just check out and bring home, The Tramp was one of those, and it was the first Chaplin film I'd ever seen. I guess I was 12 years old, maybe. And I found it to be a very sad film. I found it to have some funny parts, but I didn't come away thinking primarily that it was a comedy. it just seemed to be kind of a sad movie about this poor guy.
Yeah.
and I just saw it again recently, maybe just 6 months ago, and it still strikes me that way in a way. It's just Now, Chaplin got here, what, in 1915?
Yeah, he arrived in January of 1915 and stayed here less than 3 months. Made only 5 films while he was here at Niles, including The Tramp, The Champion. His first one was A Night Out.
Mm-hmm.
And he made A Jitney Elopement mostly in Golden Gate Park and in the park, all in Golden Gate Park. And there were actually some scenes shot in Oakland, I discovered, for A Night Out. Some apartment buildings that were doubling as hotels. Buildings are still there.
Mm.
I was able to, after years of going to the Oakland Public Library, I realized that I'd been driving by one of those locations hundreds of times.
Now, was there a stage here? Did they shoot inside at all, or did they just build their interior sets outside?
For the first year, they had a open-air stage behind a barn on 2nd Street. And half a block away, they built 6 bungalows for cast and crew because there was a housing shortage in Niles. And the next year, they built a full studio, $52,000 worth, with a glass-enclosed stage and 4 more bungalows. And they used that until they closed down in February of 1916. So they had the glass-enclosed stage, and they also had a smaller interior stage with that needed lighting totally. And but, of course, they used outside, and there was quite a bit of area around the studio, fenced-in portion. In fact, in the Champion film, you can see a point where Chaplin walks along a sidewalk with a fence on it, and that's the studio fence. Mm. There he goes through a door that goes into the back of the studio itself in the grassy area where he's waiting on the bench to fight that fighter. That was all behind the studio building. So, in fact, in the later on the film, when he's ducking away from a cop, there's a front of the studio building itself that goes all along Niles Boulevard, and you can see the whole face of the studio going off into the distance in that film. So they use that, and of course, in every Bronco Billy film, you'd see the canyon just about, and most of the Snakevilles as well. They did have also a false front set in front of several of the studio storage buildings and a blacksmith shop in an alleyway that was right facing the rear of the studio bungalows. And they used that false front set quite a bit, too, so they could control, you know, no crowds. Every time you see some of the streets, when they actually went on the street, if there was any glass fronts, you could see people reflected in the windows, you know. So
how many of those buildings survive? Any?
None of the studio buildings survive. The 10 houses that were built for cast and crew are all now private residences. Anderson spent his own money on the houses, and when he sold off the property in the 20s, they actually had to pull a couple of houses out because when he built them, they all crossed the property lines. And so he had to move those houses to other spots in Niles so that he could spread out the other houses and put them back on the property lines.
Wow.
So
that sounds like a complicated process.
Yeah, well, there was a lot of moving done in Niles itself. If you go through town, I bet I could point out about 15 or 20 buildings that have been moved from one place to another. Wow. In Niles. And there's probably more that I don't know about. There was some local people who became pretty expert at doing it. We've actually got a photograph collection of a local general contractor named E.E. Diaz, who actually was a camera bug, too, and so he took photographs of these houses being moved from one place to another.
Wow. We're running low on time, so I wanted to talk about the Market Street film before we do.
Uh-huh.
Probably a lot of people are aware of this, but I find it fascinating. And so basically it's a film that was thought to be made in 1905 on Market Street in San Francisco. So, and basically it was just, what, a camera on the front of a trolley car or something? It just went from one end of Market Street to the other?
Yeah, yeah, a cable car. In those days, cable cars ran down Market Street to the ferry building and back. And, you know, the film had been in circulation really continuously, but for some reason people had forgotten who made it and just when it was made. And the Library of Congress had a great site where you could see the whole film, and it had this long explanation of all the different buildings that you can see as you travel down the street towards the ferry building. And based upon that, based on the state of construction on Market Street and the angle of the sun, and you can actually read the clock time on the ferry building, they estimated that it was filmed somewhere in September 1905. And as a result of that, the Exploratorium decided to have this celebration at Embarcadero, where they would show the film, and they actually did a recreation. My friend Sprague Anderson took his hand crank camera, and they went down Market Street on a trolley car, and he cranked the camera going towards the market, the ferry building, and they showed that film. He shot it in 35, and I guess they showed some other films, and so there was a whole big write-up in the local papers and, you know, quite a bit of publicity. And I wasn't able to go to the showing. There was something else that I had to do, probably here in Niles. But it really sparked my interest in the film again. I'd seen it many times myself. And I thought, 1905, making a movie on Market Street would have been a huge, big deal. Why wouldn't somebody have written something about it at the time? And so I thought I'd look through all the five San Francisco newspapers and see if I could find something. And so I went to the microfilm, and I actually looked from August through October 1905 and couldn't find a thing about any filming being made at that time. I studied the film real closely after that and noticed that there was some sections, especially towards the end, where there's big puddles of water on the street. And I thought, well, maybe there was a recent rain. So we went back to those papers during that time period and looked at the weather reports. And it was totally dry. There wasn't a drop of rain during that time period in San Francisco. So I thought, boy, this is kind of interesting. Why would that be? I realized that there was another time of year where the angle of the sun and the time on the clock would be pretty similar, and that would be on the other side of June 21st, say around March or April. And because of the state of the construction on Market Street, it wouldn't have been 1905. And it couldn't have been later than that, 1907, say, because it's obvious that the cars on the tracks on Market Street are cable cars. And after the earthquake, the line was electrified and trolley cars ran. After that, there were no more cable cars. So it seemed like March or April would have been the time of year that maybe this was filmed. So I looked back at the newspapers for that time period. Couldn't find any articles, but I did notice the weather reports. There was a huge amount of rain towards the end of March 1906. And a little bit into April, I think. Thanks to my research on SNA, I realized that there was a trade magazine during that time where all of the film manufacturers advertised, and that was the New York Clipper. So I went to that trade magazine, which happened to be on microfilm at the San Francisco Public Library, and I found an advertisement by the Miles Brothers for April 21st, 1906, that advertised two new films that they were going to put out that were specified for the Hales Tours theaters, kind of theaters that kind of simulated a railroad ride where you had the screen at the front of the car, and people sat like they were in a railroad car. Mm-hmm. And the first film that they were going to release was A Trip Down Mount Tamalpais, which they actually copyrighted on April 21st, 1906. And that's one of those typical things that, you know, it's like a 12-minute film going down this gravity car in Mill Valley from Mount Tamalpais down into the station, continuous run. And the second street was a trip through Market Street, as they advertised it, which sounded suspiciously like a trip down Market Street. It even said that it starts at 8th Street and goes to the Ferry Building. The earthquake happened on April 18th, 1906. So the obviously from the advertisements, and if you look at the New York Clipper issue for that date, there's no mention of the earthquake. So everything had been written up before that and to go to the printers. But on the April 28th issue, suddenly, you know, word about the earthquake is everywhere. And even in the next Miles Brothers advertisement, where they describe in detail the filming of that film, and Joe and Harry Miles going back on the train towards their New York office to deliver the film for printing and distribution. And en route, they discovered that there's an earthquake, so they take the film continues on to New York. It had actually left San Francisco the night before the earthquake. Wow. And they go back to San Francisco with all the film equipment to film the aftermath of the earthquake. And in a later advertisement, when they're actually selling off used copies of the film in June of 1906, they actually specify that the film was shot 4 days before the earthquake. Hmm. So and later on, thanks to the digital age, I was actually able to find a San Francisco Call newspaper article that for March 31st, 1906, that said that the Miles Brothers had requested the use of a cable car from the Market Street Railway to shoot Market Street for filmmaking, for the world to see Market Street, one of the most beautiful streets in the world. So it's pretty remarkable that nobody had really kind of figured out that the Miles Brothers, who were the first bi-coastal movie company, it would have made sense, being in San Francisco and New York, that they would have been the ones to film this thing years ago, but nobody took the trouble or the effort to figure it out before.
Yeah. So this film, which is fascinating on its own just for its view of this street in San Francisco and all the cars and the people and the carriages and, mm-hmm. and all that, once you realize that it's just days before the earthquake, then it becomes a completely different thing. It's this poignant look at all these people who are undoubtedly going to be dead in just days, and all these buildings that are going to be gone, and it's just it really makes it a moving experience to watch this thing.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing what it adds to it. There were some Rick Prelinger had a really great quality 35mm nitrate of the film that's more complete than anybody else's. It's still missing a little bit of footage. But he'd put that on the Internet Archive, and I was actually able to see license plate numbers off some of the cars. I was able to find 5 license plate numbers. I thought, well, maybe this could be an additional cooperation. Maybe one of the cars is a Miles Brothers car. It turned out that none of them were, but I did find out that one of the license plates was registered in January of 1906 and another one in February of 1906. And there actually were some other license plate numbers that I was able to read later on when I could actually look at the 35mm print itself. But cars had started being registered in California in 1905. So there weren't very many numbers. It had gone up to about 8,000 by that time. But to think that I actually was able to find out that after being told that nothing like that existed anymore, that the car registration records were still at the California State Archive. They only had them alphabetically, so I had to look through every one of them. But I was able to identify the owners of all of the automobiles that you could read the license plate numbers for.
Wow.
And, one of the license plates was number 6.
Wow. That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess theoretically you could track down those people and see.
As a matter of fact, there's one driver who circles around about 6 times and comes back. His name is Jay Anway. And just about 6 months ago, a granddaughter of Jay Anway's emailed me and actually emailed me some photographs of Jay Anway from the front so I can actually see what he looks like, because all I could see before was the back of his head.
Wow. See, everything about this story is fascinating to me. Everything about it. That's amazing.
It also resulted in me being on 60 Minutes because a producer for 60 Minutes was shown the story... the film by his wife, who was interested in it as well. And he was interested because he'd actually worked when he was still a student at San Francisco State at some of the TV stations in town. And now he's a 60-minute producer, and showed it to Morley Safer, who was also fascinated by the film and the story. And so they actually came here to Niles and interviewed me and some other people in San Francisco and put that thing on 60 Minutes in October of 2010. So that was really great to see that. As a result of that, at the end of the year, the film went on the 25 films for the year from the National Registry, the Library of Congress. So it all kind of... Oh. Went together that year.
Yeah, that's such an amazing story to me. We should really wrap it up. I'm sure you have other things to do than just yak with me all day. Although I could do it all day long.
Yeah.
But thanks very much. I want to urge anybody who's listening to this, if you've never been to Niles, you ought to come. The theater is terrific. I love seeing movies here. It's really as close as you can get in most, unless you live in some really weird place, to a genuine silent movie experience. I mean, the theater looks authentic to the time, and the you even have metal walls in the projection booth.
We've got the tin line projection booth that we use, and we've even got a hand cranked Powers Camerograph projector that occasionally we put into position and crank out a film.
And you give tours of the theater, and
we do, yeah.
Do you ever give tours of the area?
Occasionally, I do.
Sign me up for one of those.
Yeah.
That would be fun.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, you can look at the 1911 Niles Jail.
Yeah.
As well as locations, film locations. It's still a pretty remarkable little town. When Bronco Billy came here, it was a railroad town, four blocks long, with the businesses on one side of the street, and now it's the businesses are five blocks long on one side of the street, so it really hasn't changed much.
And if you like antique stores, this is the place to come.
There's a lot of that.
There are lots of them. And so, yeah, it's always fun to be here. So thanks very much, Dave. I really appreciate
it. Oh, you're welcome.
Goodness. I sure hope you enjoyed my talk with David Keene. I really did, and I'm going to be going back to Niles as soon as I can, not only to see some movies, but to talk with David some more. And also, the great Sam Gill lives up there, and I'm going to get him on this podcast by hook or by crook. And it'll probably be by crook, because I'm not above doing that. I've got a crook that I use for just such an occasion. So that's going to be coming up. And if you're ever in the area, please go there. It's great. And it's great just to walk around. And if you know anything about the history of the area, it's just an incredibly fascinating place to go to. I also want to put in a shameless plug for myself, and it won't do me any good. That's why I can do these kind of plugs, because I get nothing from the sale of this thing. But Kino Lorber recently put out the new Blu-ray of the 1932 film White Zombie. And I've always been really fond of that film. It's got a great, I'll use dreadful in the proper sense, a sense of dread about the whole thing. And it's just a beautiful horror film, beautifully shot. And this Blu-ray is quite something. And I was lucky enough to be asked to do the commentary track for it. So if you look on Amazon, and I hope that you'll click through the link on my page, thecommentarytrack.com, or on my personal page, frankthompson.tv, either way, you'll see an Amazon link to this Blu-ray of White Zombie, and I know that you'll enjoy it. I had a great time doing it. My friend Tom Holland produced the restoration of the film, which the negatives of White Zombie have disappeared, as far as I know. And Tom discovered a 35mm print that was struck in the 1960s from the original negative. So even though it was not in perfect shape by any means, it was really the best preprint that this film has seen in a long time. And they did digital cleanup and all that sort of stuff on it and cleaned up the sound, and it's really a beauty. But also, Tom was keenly aware that there are purists who don't like digital cleanup and think that it always robs the film of too much grain and so forth. And so what he suggested doing was to put just the straight transfer of the 35mm print on the disc as well, as a bonus track. So you actually have the movie in two different ways, and if one seems too clean and pristine for you, then the other one looks just like it looks, and so you get the best of both worlds. There's also a brief interview with Bela Lugosi, who is the star of the film, of course, who plays a character with one of the great names in a horror film, Murder Le Gendre. Little interview with him, and I think there's a trailer, but of course the main selling point, let's be frank, is me, because I talk all the way through it. I just keep talking all the way through the film, and I talk about where it was shot and
how it was made and who the people were and all kinds of interesting tidbits. And I think that you'll really like it. If you don't know the film, it's a beauty. It's really something. It almost works as a silent film better than a sound film because, let's be honest, the acting is not all that great in many cases, except for Lugosi, who's always terrific. But visually, it's just stunning, and it really does have a creepy aura about it, and it's just a great horror film and the very first zombie film. So there you go. So that's my shameless plug. Go to my Amazon links. And if you, while you're ordering that, order more of my books and more of the videos that I've had connections with. And also, most important, order David Keene's book, Bronco Billy and the SNA Film Company, which if you have any interest in that era of film history, you will find totally fascinating. Beautifully written, thoroughly researched, and lots and lots and lots of great pictures. This is a terrific book. Please buy it. You will not regret it. It's great. And again, I get nothing from that either. I'm always urging you to buy things for which I do not profit. That makes me kind of a saint, I think. That's what I believe, anyway. I want to thank my wonderful wife, Claire, for being my announcer. I want to thank James Hutchins for designing my websites. Thank, of course, the great Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand for writing my theme music fore and aft. And I want to thank you for listening. And I especially want to thank you for going to iTunes and leaving me a good review and a 5-star rating and telling other people to do the same thing. And also like me on Facebook. There's a commentary track page on Facebook. Please like me there. I have like 1,200 Facebook friends and only 119 people like the commentary track website. The commentary track Facebook page. So, come on, I could do better than that. Please go in and like the page, tell people about this, and let's build an audience. I've got some great guests coming up. I think I've always had great guests. I don't think there's been a disappointment in the lot so far. But I've got some coming up that will actually stun you. You'll be thinking, how the heck did he get that one on the show? And it's because everybody who listens to the commentary track wants to be on it. It's like the old Batman series. The stars are pleading with me to be on this. Not pleading per se, but reluctantly willing to be on it, which is pretty much the same thing in my world. So keep listening, tell your friends, and we'll see you next week. In the meantime, don't you worry. We'll fix it in post.